2003 here in the United States. Boy, Kevin, I should have sent you an MP3 of the Beatles' Taxman this afternoon. That would have been appropriate music for today. If I have a chance, I'll dig it up. We'll risk the violation of the royalty fee for one time, I guess, if I can find it in time. But we're back again. It is the Tuesday night edition of the Linux Show. We are expecting a smaller than usual audience because it's tax day here in the United States. But we'll see. We'll see if I'm proven wrong. But it sure seems like, based upon the initial traffic that we've seen coming in over the last hour or so, that it's going to be a little bit of a slimmer audience group than normal. That might give some of you who have always wanted to get in on the IRC an opportunity to do so. There'll be less people crowding, less people making comments, so it's an opportunity to get involved. Go to our IRC server, that's irc.thelinuxshow.com, and the chat room everybody's in, the channel is Linux Show, so check us out. We got, I believe the whole crew is here. Did I just hear you beep in, Doc?
Yes, you did. I had to run around and find a phone with a living battery, so... But I found one in the house, so.
So we're all here.
We're here.
So Doc, how are things where you are at tonight?
It's after several days of rain. It's gorgeous. It's absolutely beautiful. A little bit on the chilly side for here. You know, probably in the low 60s, something like that.
But the mountains have all a nice coating of snow on them.
They do where you are, yeah. So you're looking up at Mount Baldy and it's snowy up there?
Yeah, Mount San Antonio, even Cucamonga Peaks got a shroud of white.
Do you, you ever go skiing up there?
No, not with my gimpy knees.
You ever go up to watch?
Yeah. I go up to Baldy Village and have a cocktail once in a while, yeah.
Yeah, I wanted to go over there. It's not far.
It's nice there.
For you, it's right next door.
We can see Mount San Gregorio here right now. I can look down the street and see Mount San Gregorio, which is over in the San Bernardino Range.
Well, and not far from you, when I was flying out of LAX a couple of weeks ago, there were a couple of mountains there that are absolutely covered with orange from California poppies.
Yeah, that's
I don't know where that is, but it's not far south of you, I think.
Yeah, it's probably, that's probably north of us, towards the desert.
Well,
and the orange poppies are beautiful this time of year. Absolutely gorgeous.
It's the range south of where you are. This is a low range. It's not a high range.
So, Doc, have you had an interesting day today with the house juggling you've done in the last 12 months? Your tax returns must have been rather interesting.
We filed our extension today with a check. So I wrote a check. The hard work was getting the fax machine to actually print out what it had spooled. The documentation is you have to, punch the right cord as the brother in Telefax, which is one of the dumbest things I've ever seen. But anyway, we had to press the right cord in order to have it print out the documentation, which allowed us to figure out what we had to do to make it disgorge the thing that it had spooled electronically.
Yeah. Now, I don't very often compliment the government, and so this is going to be a rare for me, but I really have to give some kudos to the IRS they have really made some dramatic improvements to their infrastructure in the last 12 months. Last night, 10:30, 11 o'clock at night, I'm right along with everybody else. I'm trying to download all the appropriate business tax forms. I had absolutely no trouble, no waiting. It was truly amazing, whereas the Illinois Department of Revenue website was completely congested, and I had to wait until about 2:30, 3 o'clock in the morning to get the forms off the state website.
Wow.
So, but really, I don't know if the rest of you have had a similar experience from what I have, but the IRS has done one heck of a job in improving their infrastructure. But, you know, they've got unlimited money, so their website ought to cook, I would hope. So, but how are you doing, Arnie?
Oh, I'm doing fine. I've had a cold all week, but that was coming on last week when doing the show, and it's you know, just one of these 10-day things, you know. It's kind of cool here, and it's supposed to rain again tomorrow, and so it's going to chill down again. And
cool there, huh? It was 90 degrees here in Chicago today.
Yeah, well, it's like 60, and it's going to be 40 tonight, and that's the way it's been for the last few days. And Southern California is just going through this cold spell, and it's an extension of winter, our winter, I guess, anyway.
Yeah, well, we had snow on the ground a week and a half ago.
Well, I'm a Michigander, so I know that scene.
90 today, snow a week and a half ago. We may have snow this weekend, for all we know.
There you go. Probably a foot and a half, right?
Well, who knows. So, hey, Russ, how are things going with you?
Things are going well. Like you, it's pretty warm in D.C. today. We were actually working up a sweat here just by walking around.
Right, it's got to be absolutely gorgeous right this minute in D.C. Absolute peak of the cherry blossoms.
Yeah, there's a lot of cherry blossoms and Bradford pears, both of them flowering up real nice all over the place. And it is a grand sign of spring, although, like you mentioned, it seems like spring may just spring right past us. And as we go from winter to summer in the case of over the spell of a few days.
Gotta love that global warming.
Something. I don't know what the hell it is, but it's screwed up big time. But outside of that, things are going okay.
Yeah. So, Kevin, how are you doing with your taxes?
Oh, got everything filed. As it turns out, for some reason, I could not get a tax cut to file through my Squid proxy. I actually had to dial up before it would go through.
I have no explanation for you. That is odd. Can't imagine why it wouldn't work. I do things the old-fashioned way. I print out the forms and mail them in.
That's what I'm doing, because I owe a little bit of money, and I'm sending in the request for loan, and I'll mail that this evening before midnight sometime. Yeah, it's all ready to go. It just has to be signed by Alice and I, and off it goes.
Well, then let's go ahead and jump right into the first segment, seeing as we've probably all got text filing to do. We'll go ahead and get started. Russ, you've got a whole bunch of stories that you sent me. Do you want to start off with one of them?
Sure. First one, all my links tonight, by the way, are on the Linux Show webpage, so people can take a look there and click away. First one is Kachingo Winner was Linux, and I hope I'm pronouncing it correctly, but it's a story from Computer World down in New Zealand. And I know that we have a few listeners down there.
Right,
but a nice little piece saying that even though this system that was deployed that was supposed to be allowing shoppers to become winners of various sundry prizes, that even though the system, I gather, wasn't the most earth-shattering in the world, the Linux part of it apparently went flawlessly. And it's a nice little success story, and one that's well worth pushing in front of people who may be looking at a Linux deployment. I think it's a nice little piece.
Hmm. Yeah. Well, speaking of New Zealand, thing is, you mentioned New Zealand. We have a bit of an anomaly to announce, even though New Zealand is a relatively small country, they appear, New Zealand appears to have become our number three largest listening audience, even passing up Australia.
My goodness.
And it's really, really right on the heels of Canada. All of the disparaging comments I have made about French Canadians over the last few months have apparently reduced our listenership up in Canada. But that aside, our listenership in New Zealand continues to grow. I gotta credit some of that to those loyal hardcore New Zealanders that are frequenting the IRC every week. So kudos to them for...
Kudos to the Kiwis.
Kudos to the Kiwis for getting your fellow Kiwis to listen to the Linux show. So, but go ahead, Russ. Jump into your second story.
Yeah, the second one is called Standards Group Beats Back Patent Foes. And this is one of those pieces that, you know, we need to pay specific attention to because, you know, here's the working group of the Internet Engineering Task Force. And there was a lot of give and take over whether or not patented technologies should be part of various Internet standards. And the bottom line here was that they refused to rule them out. And, you know, it's the balancing act between some people who, you know, the open source people who want to make sure that whatever is on the Internet, whatever is a standard on the Internet, can be implemented in open source versus some commercial entities, reportedly including IBM, that want to make sure that they can make money off of the wonderful technologies that they come up to. And as such, the working group decided that that they would not restrict the use of patented technologies. They're still using, I guess, the RAND technologies. What is that? I'm blanking out on this one. Reasonable and something or other. the meaning of RAND. But this is one of those things that we need to keep dealing with and keep fighting for, that we don't see the day when the Internet becomes mainly exists to create money. It wasn't designed to do that, and I don't think anyone here probably has any objection to people making money on the Internet, but we have to make sure that the Internet does not become a proprietary thing.
There's a lot of articles written about this meeting. And different authors really wrote on this in different ways, I'm really myself not clear yet of what this all means, because some people have seemed to taken this as a preservation of the status quo, and In essence, is there anything wrong with preserving the status quo of the Internet? I don't know if there really is anything wrong, you know, particularly wrong with that, because all the IETF was really saying was that they weren't going to make proprietary technology, you know, rule it out, even though they would, you know, most of the members on the IETF board would prefer that the standards be open standards. They just didn't want to rule it out as much in principle as anything else. A lot of people have also interpreted this as, at least it seems, as an open door that now the W3 is fair game for the digital rights industries. I don't know if that's true at all. I really don't. I don't know if there's a clear picture coming out of this. Doc, have you got any real take from anybody on this yet?
I'm sorry. I was busy trying to get ahead of my news on what exactly. Forgive me.
Okay. No, that's okay. But does anybody else have a comment on this? Because I don't know if there's really a clear message here yet.
Well, I see a lot of things happening that is also restricting the portability of basically net-enabled apps. You know, my stepdaughter tonight wants me to help her get on a chat thing to interface to a junior college, which she's taking some courses at. And, of course, it's a proprietary chat. And, you know, I was grumbling while I'm trying to help her out. And you know, why aren't they using IRC? I mean, it's like it's available, and there's even web-enabled IRC that's off-the-shelf available, which for Java, which is completely and totally standard. And, of course, they have this proprietary thing that requires you install a CD, you know, and she doesn't have a CD, so now she's dead in the water, and she's got this assignment. You know, you got the picture.
Yep.
And why, the question is, why do they do that? Why don't they just use the technology technology that's portable?
Mm. Well, I could probably give you an answer.
No, it's money. You know.
It's also industry specific. If it's a school, schools are dominated by their vertical market vendors, and within the educational community, the vertical market members are proprietary to the minutiae level.
I mean, there's even Jabber. If they want to do proprietary, they can use the Jabber thing. But you know, Jabber works.
Yep.
You can make proprietary.
Well, there's plenty of non-proprietary.
I mean, it's just there's all so many things available that wouldn't lock people out, and yet here she's going through this hideous frustration, and I feel for her. Poor, she's having trouble.
Yeah. Well, one thing it does make us aware of, and one of the people in the chat room last week, immediately at the end of the show, reminded me that they had sent me an email before the show saying, make sure you put in a word for the Linux standards space, because we have a tendency of forgetting about that. And we have conversations about the progress of open source, and the Linux standards base sort of falls to the back burner at times, and we need to focus on standards.
By the way, my stepdaughter is running the only computer in the household that runs Windows. You know,
that's okay.
I mean, it's okay. I mean, that's what she wants. That's what she needs. But it's still, even with that, she's locked out.
I wish I had one here because, of those, you know, I get shit in the mail. I'd like to be able to see what it is sometimes, you know.
Oh, I have no problem with that. I have open Office installed, and I am using EXMH for my mail client, and I pump it through MailCrypt, and it brings up the browser, and I can click right through. It's perfect.
I think what Jack's probably referring to is applications he's getting in the mail.
Yeah, I'm going to be recording something in New York for a company in a couple of weeks, and so they send me a CD, you know, and it's just, you know, I stick it in various machines, and nothing happens, and I realize, oh, God, it's a Windows thing, and I don't have one of those working here right now. So.
Buy a laptop, and you'll get Windows.
Yeah.
Whether you like it or not.
Buy money first, that would help.
We'll talk about that later in the show. But, Russ, the next story on your list is the state of Linux in Maine.
Yeah, and in fact, this has a lot to do with some of the things that you and Arnie were just talking about, having to do with schools. And
exactly.
This is a terrific article, and I really do recommend that people take, you know, the 5 minutes and read this over. It's terrific in a lot of ways in that it shows that there's a lot of intelligence going into this, that here you have not a school system that, you know, is some sort of Luddite sort of thing that is going to Linux, or some school system that just has no money, and so that's the basic thing. You have a school system that actually wants to do the right thing with technology and is very active with technology, but they have to be wise with their money, et cetera, et cetera. And so here they are, you know, looking at Linux to do all the right things. I mean, you know, it's once again, push from below. You have individuals there working to try to get things to come along in open source, but it seems like there are victories along the way. And this particular article highlights several good pieces of technology for schools, and it refers to the eSmith SME server. That's one, frankly, that I've been running at home for, I guess, jeepers, 2.5 years now. Excellent.
Yeah. This story talks again about another victory for the Linux Terminal Project. Every couple of weeks you see another major story coming out on some large school district that after looking at the cost of license migration because of threatened prosecution by Microsoft's lackeys, the Business Software Alliance, the school districts are more and more moving over to the Linux Terminal Project. It's remarkable.
Well, there's also a K12OS, which is a Linux terminal technology. And by the way, I read that article, and it's a really excellent article. The one that Russ is mentioning, and I highly recommend it.
Okay, another one.
And my final one is I'm actually not even going to talk about it much, but it's called Who's the J Boss. And the reason why I have this one up is that, Lord willing, we're going to have someone from JBoss on next week to talk about this. So give a gander to this article if you don't know anything about the project. It's got some very interesting pieces to it, and we'll be discussing that hopefully in detail, hopefully next week.
Yep. I'd like to jump over to Doc next. Doc sent me an interesting email or posed an interesting question earlier today, and sort of popped into my head as a line from the Slim Shady song, and that is, will the real Linux laptop vendor please stand up? And that made me really curious, and I have to ask you, Doc, I had thought that the people at Lindos had conquered that space.
Well, I don't think they've conquered the space. I mean, they've got an entry in the space, but I haven't seen any traction off it yet. You know, I mean, you know, we gave it a little bit of a publicity bump, but I haven't heard much more.
Now, the price that they came out of the gate with was what, $8.99, right?
$7.99.
Yeah. Could it be that a week later, after they came out, that Dell came out with an $800 laptop?
No, I don't think so. We could look, I suppose.
That did happen.
Oh, it did? That might be it. I don't know.
And that may have taken the sizzle away from it.
It's entirely possible. I mean, you can get you get your $800 Dell and
Well, it's fine, except for when you get your $800 Dell, what are you getting? You're getting Windows. What if you want a Linux laptop?
Well, maybe you can convert it. I don't know.
Well, man.
You know, with the laptops, the problem is a whole bunch of arcane device drivers and stuff. There are no white laptops. That's the white box laptops. I may be wrong about that. I mean, obviously, you know, it's possible to put Linux on a lot of laptops. So, but
there is a manufacturer out west that is manufacturing a line of pseudo white box laptops, but they are not laptops in the sense, they are not white boxes in the sense that we look at a desktop system of being ultimately generic. They have basically just created a standard configuration that they will allow people to put their own private label on. And so it's not really the same kind of a cookie cutter type thing that white box computers are.
Yeah, I also noticed, by the way, that Lindos is not promoting the laptop on their front page like they were before.
Yep.
You know? I don't know, you know, because they're, You know, now there is a. Yeah, I'm looking on there. Click on the logos below to, you know. So, you know, they have a list of guys you can buy them from. Okay, sub300.com sells a laptop. You know, so, but, oh, there it is, Windows Mobile PC. But it's not a Living Link. So I got a feeling they're not pushing this like they were, but I don't know. I don't know. I don't want to speak all the way out of school here, but I'm looking at the list of vendors below, and I'm not seeing them. I mean, there's iDot, which is the people that supposedly made it, and there's not a picture of the laptop in the legend.
Yep.
So I have a feeling that they're not pushing it right now.
Well, I can't answer this question on Linux laptops because it bewilders me as well. But I do have to tell everybody that if you weren't aware, last Friday, history was made. A Linux PC was sold on the Home Shopping Network.
Oh,
wow.
It was the Zaris.
Oh, really?
Well, last week, yeah. Yeah, one of my friends got one for $180.
$200.
That's a discount coupon, too.
Yeah. If you were a first-time buyer, it was $189 if you were a first-time buyer. But the list price on it was $199. And they divided the lot in half and sold out half of them at midnight on Friday night, and then again at like 9 o'clock Eastern time on Saturday morning. They sold the other half out, and they blew out of Home Shopping Network in like a matter of 15 minutes for each show. So there are now several thousand Linux handheld computers out there, thanks to the people at the Home Shopping Network. Once again, you know, it's not the traditional computer venues that seem to be making the big splash for Linux devices. It's the Walmart. It's the Home Shopping Club.
Yeah.
I mean, this goes to that theme that we were talking about last week in terms of the commoditization of computers. This really is turning into an inevitability when you see these Zoris, the Linux-powered Zoris, selling on the Home Shopping Network. It's just utterly amazing.
I might add that the reason why the Zoris was on this Home Shopping Network is because Sharp has got the new 5600 coming out, which instead of having a strong ARM CPU has the X scale Intel.
And a bunch more RAM.
It's not a bunch more RAM. It's actually less RAM, but it's reconfigured differently. And it's got more flash, and they're using flash for storage, where they in the 5500 they use RAM, which should make the 5600 a little bit more stable. Basically, the two are basically the similar. When they're configured, they're going to have a similar amount of free storage. The other thing that the 5600 has that the 55 doesn't have is a speaker, a real speaker, and a microphone.
Yeah, so you.
But other than that, we're talking about the same thing.
Yeah, but the theory is you probably will be able to use the 5600 as a cell phone very soon. That's what I'm.
I hadn't heard that, but that wouldn't surprise me.
That's what I'm hearing, is that there's going to be some kind of a MCA card that you slide in that turns it into either a Wi-Fi phone or a cell phone. So, it's inevitable.
It's a bit thicker in the bottom than the 5500. It's got a bigger battery, which sticks out at the bottom. So. Yeah, at the back, actually, a little bit. It's a little thicker.
Slightly larger footprint.
It's basically the same machine, same thing, only different.
But still, I thought everybody would be interested in hearing about their huge success at the Home Shopping Network.
They got flash dotted, though.
Who, Home Shopping Network?
Yeah, the flash dot crowd were buying all the Zorises.
Yep. that's amazing when you think about it. All the criticisms that you've heard on places like Flashdat about the mindless automatons of people who buy stuff on the home shopping network. It's sort of funny. Doc, do you have any more stories for us this week?
Well, there are a couple that we put up on the show site. One is that Microsoft is licensing Windows Media Player for embedded Linux devices. So there's an admission that's certainly there on Microsoft's part that embedded Linux is becoming one of the default media player operating systems, and so they need to have that if they want Windows Media Player to work in as much of the world as possible. They need to support that platform. So that's just an interesting little item. There's a link on there on the site about that. Below that is the ongoing question about Centrino drivers. I put up a piece that was retrospective to some degree on my encounter with Paul Otellini, the COO and president of Intel at PC Forum last week. Did we cover that last week?
Yes, we did.
We did.
Did they follow up on it with you?
Huh?
Did they follow up on that at all with you?
No. Aside from the fact that they announced that the drivers would be available, I haven't heard anything more about that. You know, it's kind of like the Lindos laptop. You know, it's like, well, there's sort of limbo information there.
I've heard one big circular quote of where you said it last week, and then somebody quoted you, and then somebody quoted them, and then somebody.
Right. Yeah.
So there's just been this big circular quote that's going around in a circle, but no one has gotten follow up from Intel confirming that this is indeed going to happen.
Well, you know, they're certainly not going out of their way to make a market here. To me, the bigger story is the one that I've been working on for 4 months. Really, since January, is about the inside view from inside large enterprises of Linux, and contrasting that with the outside view that we read in the mainstream press. And I hadn't realized until really the last several weeks the degree to which every story, pretty much, that you read in the mainstream press filters Linux through vendors. It proceeds from the assumption that, you know, Linux didn't succeed until IBM made it so and rescued it from the hippies and, you know, that all that business. And it's so utterly wrong and so completely at variance with what's actually happening. I had a long conversation with Roland Smith, who runs one of the four major IT divisions of LSI Logic in Colorado Springs. And LSI Logic is a big ASIC chip company. That's been around quite a long time, and the interesting thing he told me is, you know, he said that, you know, and it's going to be in Linux Journal pretty soon. I have an interview with him. He just isn't up yet. He needs to go through it. But he's perfectly okay with this information being out there. He said that the company wanted to put SAP, which is a big, you know, one of the big enterprise applications onto Linux, and for an ASP server or something like that, an application server, an SAP application server on Linux, because they're running everything else they possibly can on Linux, and that's more or less the orientation of the company. The CIO now says to everybody who comes in with any kind of what they call a solution, does it run on Linux, and if it doesn't, go away and make it run on Linux. But in the meantime, you know, what he said is he went to HP and to Dell and said, okay, we want to do this on a server. We want to replace our HP UX servers with Linux to run this SAP application. What can you tell us? What can you do for us? And HP fumbled around for weeks before saying they didn't know. And Dell said, we don't know, but we'll loan you a server and you tell us. You know, go figure it out. We want to know, too. But here, we'll loan you a server and take a few months and figure out what to do with it. And they went to Red Hat, and Red Hat said, well, we think it runs on our advanced server, but you tell us. And they went to SAP, and SAP said, well, we think it runs on Red Hat 7.1, but we don't know. Go figure it out. And they went to Susie, and Susie hardly told him anything. And the upshot of this is that all of the intelligence that matters is on the customer side. It's happening inside the companies. It's not happening in the big vendors. And this is not to knock those vendors. It's responsible on the part of those vendors to say, we're relying on you guys to tell us this. But the interesting thing is that the corollary of what Bill Joy said quite a few years ago now, that most of the, all the smartest people don't work for your company. He said that back at a time when what that meant was they all worked for other companies. But what it means now is they work for your customers. They work for your customers. Interestingly, that when LSI Logic went with Linux several years ago, when it got started under Roland's leadership, he basically told his team, we need to replace some HPUX servers. Go tell us what we can do with Linux, because he was running Linux at home at that time. And they came back. They did a real strong study on it, came back, and the upshot of that was they bought 50 Penguin servers. And had a hard time selling it inside the company. And the company, he says now, is completely transformed. They are now, very rah-rah about Linux, but not in a kind of evangelical way. Just in a, look, this is just like, we used to build with bricks, and now we're building with 2x4s. So if you want to work with us, you're going to have to give us something that we can, work with 2x4s on. And that's just one story. I mean, there are other stories going on with other companies. Orbitz, the big online travel site, right? The guys that had those pop-up ads that ran forever, right? But these are, this is a company put together by the five leading airlines, okay? All Linux, 100%. Every possible thing they could do is running on Linux.
Amazon.
Huh?
Amazon runs Linux.
Amazon, too. But we know about Amazon, right? Amazon's going out of their way to say so. But Orbitz, it's not even a big deal, see? But they're not even that crazy about letting it be known because they see it as a competitive advantage. They're getting more out of Linux than their competitors are. They're kind of ahead on the curve. These are stories that are not being told in the mainstream. It's still the same old, it's sort of a hippie thing, and we're waiting for the market to decide, and yada yada. Well, the market's running ahead of them.
Well, the other thing, Doc, is that these are the type of things, and it's happening, and I agree, it's happening all over the place. But these are precisely the type of measurements that aren't being measured.
No,
and the consulting firms, the IT consulting firms, aren't reporting this kind of thing.
No, you know who's reporting?
They're not measuring it.
Goldman freaking Sachs is reporting it.
Yeah, Merrill Lynch probably.
Goldman Sachs had his big paper called "Fear the Penguin" that came out in January.
Yeah,
that's right.
And there was a big piece. I think we looked at it last week in Computer World with
Merrill Lynch.
With Merrill Lynch, exactly. And I tried to follow up with the that guy, but he's been moved into another division. They've got a new open source guy. But the thing is, they're growing all over the place around this, and it's all about. It's all about getting smarter internally and economizing internally. And it's DIY. It's all Home Depot. It's the DIY market.
Yeah.
And in many cases, they're using free and open source software that costs zero. And when they feel like having a relationship with somebody, they'll call up MySQL. One company that's coming out really strong in this is Oracle. On the one hand, there's no doubt that MySQL and Postgres threaten Oracle from below. But a lot of these big companies have very strong relationships with Oracle, and they're glad to pay the freight, and Oracle is very glad to be running on Linux. And Oracle has totally changed its tune over the years from being OS agnostic to being very rah-rah about Linux. And Roland Smith told me that Oracle is by far the most hip company about Linux that he's run across. And I asked who the least is, and he said Siebel. So, it's interesting how, the customers like that have a lot of leverage.
I would have thought he would have said Microsoft.
Well, I suppose so, but that sort of goes without saying. Yeah. But these guys are not in the traditional Linux community. They're not having the arguments about licensing, and they're not having, but they're involved. I mean, Wim Kokerts, who runs the Linux development at Oracle, told me that, their fingerprints are all over the 2.6 kernel.
Yep. Well, I tell you, there's some smarts going down in some of these big companies when it comes to providing, starting to provide products to the Linux consumer base as well. Probably a perfect example that you can cite to this is, okay, we've got this existing model out there of the failed ASP industry, where so many businesses try to provide services online that were operating system agnostic, and it just, as an industry, completely collapsed. But we've got a handful of companies out there, Intuit being one of them, that is as diehard a Microsoft company as they get, and yet has gone back to the ASP model internally, even though they know it failed industry-wide, because they feel it is their opportunity to address that growing Linux market segment without having to redevelop a new product. And so they've been doing a good deal of promoting of, I think they call it Radio TurboTax or something like that, that's a new product for them that is in an attempt to try to appeal to your Linux and Macintosh users on an ASP model. And their plans are apparently to have a ASP version of QuickBooks available very, very shortly to companion with this product. So
it is inevitable. I mean, now that they've got QuickBooks running on OS X, it's probably inevitable that they're ready to move that to Linux. I can tell you that the moment that QuickBooks becomes available on Linux, that's going to just move an awful lot of small businesses.
And consumers.
Yeah, absolutely. But QuickBooks is not a consumer product. It is a small business product.
It's got
a business product, period.
But Quicken.
Quicken, absolutely.
Quicken.
Same thing.
Well, QuickBooks comes, Quicken comes.
Well,
they're both based in the same engine.
They're very independent development teams. They're not very similar.
Nope.
Don't they use the same type of...
Nope. They even interface with completely different products within their tech software.
Yeah, they're weird. They're pretty independent, from what I gather. But nonetheless, I mean, there is going to be a tipping point. And the question is, who tips it? You know, I mean, Intel's not going to, you know, they've got the innovator's dilemma. You know, they don't want to hit that spot where all of a sudden Moore's Law runs out because there's no customer demand for it. And that's going to happen, you know. That's one of the things I'm hearing from these companies as well. It's like, wait, we don't want the 4 gigahertz machine, you know. We're looking to leverage what we've got. We're looking for, you know, cheap generic hardware that we can swap stuff in and out on. We're looking for software that runs on it. You know, they're perfectly glad to have big relationships with big software companies, but they want it on their terms. And companies like Oracle are giving it to them. And companies like SAP are learning. And apparently companies like Siebel still haven't got the clues. But in some cases, you know, no companies at all are involved. But it's a big deal. But it's happening. And it's happening in a big way. By the way, a piece of news that I forgot is that our pal Dave Sifry, who works for Sputnik, they have today come out with their Linux-based AP120 wireless access point, which is an enterprise product, by the way.
Dave.
Yeah. You just go to Sputnik.com, and you stick it in, and it auto-configures, figures out where it is in your LAN, puts up a dynamic firewall, figures out, you know, a whole bunch of stuff, and puts out its Wi-Fi signal, and it costs $185 if you want to buy the...
$185, I'd hardly call that enterprise.
No. But he says it's competing against the Cisco item selling for $800, and OEM basically wants to sell it to OEMs for under that price. So that's what he told me on the phone. So anyway, I just I told him I'd mention it. So
well, kudos to Dave.
He's done a lot of. I mean, the amazing thing about what he's done is that on his weekends and in his spare time, he's created Technorati, which is the possibly the biggest resource ever developed to leverage RSS feeds in the weblog world. It's pretty amazing, and it's his own hack. and while he's been doing all this other stuff, because he is the technical guy for Sputnik, so he did all of the work on this. They give away the firmware on that, by the way, to their OEMs. So
yeah, you'll have
been
to
a busy boy.
You have to email me about the Technorati thing.
Yeah,
I have not been following that for months.
Yeah, just look at technorati.com. It's pretty amazing. If you've got a weblog, you can, or anything for that matter, and you can go there and see who's linking to it, who the, you know, how in live time.
Yep.
Pretty neat.
Yep. No, the RSS feed space. That's going to be a big story.
Oh, it's huge. It's changing publishing totally.
But over the course of the next year, people have no clue yet how big this is going to be. It's just starting to explode.
Yeah. Here's a cool thing. You can go to the Linux. You can go to technorati.com.
Can you spell that for everybody?
T-E-C-H-N-O-R-A-T-I, like, you know, glitterati or literati. It's technorati, R-A-T-I.com. And look for the Linux show, and it'll show all of the people linking into us right now. So there's EvTech, there's Linux Lobby, there's Linux at the Labs, AOTC, of course. those are the four that are like currently linking to the show. You know, so
R-O-T-I?
Yeah.
.com.
R-A-T-I.
Yeah.
Oh.
Technorati.
Yeah, technorati.com.
So how far down the list is the Linux show?
Oh no, it's not a list. In other words, you simply type in the Linux show's URL and it tells you who's linking into the Linux show in the last 48 hours. And ranked by freshness. And you can also rank it other ways.
Very cool.
When you rank it by authority, then AOTC goes to the top.
Well, that's really cool.
Yeah. So it's pretty neat, and we're doing. Don't want to say give away too much yet, but we're going to be doing some interesting thing with blogs at Linux Journal pretty soon. So, and next week, by the way, I'll be at the Emerging Tech Conference, and so I'll be calling in from there. This is the O'Reilly Emerging Technology Conference in San Jose.
Very cool.
And we're hoping to be having some interesting blog stuff happen there, among other things. So we shall see.
Okay. Arnie, do you have any stories of the week for us?
Oh, yeah. I got a really big one. Novell is going to be supporting Linux. And there's an interview in Computer World with the Novell CEO, Jack Messman, who is apparently the way I read this is they're pulling an IBM. They're basically saying, we can't lick you, we're going to join you. And they're, I believe, going to join Linux in a big way, and this is big, 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 big news. Novell has always been a very, very stable system. You know, I used it for years ago, and it was always good, reliable, rock solid. And this is what he says. The guy is interviewing him. He says, so you're talking about Novell making changes to the Linux kernel itself. He says, when you're developing Linux software, you find either glitches that need to be fixed or a capability that you can put into the kernel. We expect most of our effort is going to be in services. And so what they're going to be doing is contributing back to the kernel for some of their network services, which will, again, make Linux more robust. They're going to do some things that IBM has been doing. And this is good news. And he calls it Linux immature, and maybe he's right. I mean, in some respects, Novell's been around for many, many years.
Well, I got a feeling there's...
this is good news.
Well, yeah, it's definitely good news, but I think there's more practicality in this than meets the eye. Over the course of, since 1999, you've been hearing a lot of news out of Novell for virtually all of their collaborative type of products, Notes and things like that, have all come out with Linux versions that will ride on top of a Linux server. And this has, in no small measure, helped Novell to preserve some market share. It's pretty expensive to deploy a Note system when you're purchasing both a lot of client licenses for a NT machine as well as a lot of client licenses for the Notes machine, or the Notesware, I should say.
Yeah, and these are the kind of services they're going to be adding. And even in the interview, it's really, I highly recommend it. Go over at Computer World, and I highly recommend you read it. It's a Q&A, and I highly recommend it be read. He even acknowledges that some of the stuff won't get into the kernel because he doesn't control that. I mean, and that's not their goal. And this is a really, really healthy, very, very responsible attitude. And so, welcome to the fold, Network.
Yeah, I think I really do think this was an inevitability.
Oh yeah, I'm sure it was. And we've been looking at it happen for some time, but it's nice to have it happen now.
Any more stories?
Yeah, I've got the Clueless Pundit of the week, and I had a hard time getting a Clueless Pundit this week because no one seemed to be wanting to make a fool of himself about Linux. But there we go, here we come. BNUNet, Colin Baker. A Linux finally goes up. And this is not a bad article on the whole, except for this guy just believes too many of these marketing surveys, Aberdeen Group and all these other people. And he says a few things that just aren't true and just kind of clueless. Like this, for instance. Let's see. According to analyst Aberdeen Group, one reason the independent software vendors have been wary of Linux is the short period between releases. ISVs need release cycles that are much longer than the 3 to 6 months that is adhered to by many Linux vendors, the analyst says in a white paper. And of course, you know, geez, well, we could do it like Microsoft does and put everything in one monolithic thing too. And then there's at the end of the article, there's another article tacked on. It says additional reporting by Lisa Kelly and James Middleton. And this is what that says. There are pros and cons. They're discussing Linux history here a little bit. And then he says, then there are pros and cons. New versions of Linux come out almost a week on almost a weekly basis. Any new idea can find its way into Linux quickly. But this does little for stability of long-term planning, which is where the established vendors come in. I mean, these people even know that there is two chains of development in the Linux kernel? I mean, this is just cluelessness at monumental cluelessness. I mean, you know.
Yeah, well, they're comparing apples and oranges in terms of the way the Linux community will quickly release a new version that's patched for some particular problem or another.
Yeah, and they're looking at that as a release schedule. Yeah. And it's interesting that they're arguing that Linux needs to be released less often. I mean, you know, how often does a kernel get into stable? How often do we get a stable kernel release? It's like a couple of years at least.
Yeah, but they're basically trying to apply the flawed Microsoft model under something that works, so it's silly.
Yeah, it's very. But there's some good content in this article. It's just that, you know, a lot of their conclusions are based on some of this flawed stuff. One little very small item, and this is just something of interest. The SARS virus was sequenced by an IBM Linux box.
Very cool. I do have a listener challenge for you, Ernie. A listener, John, has emailed me and has asked you to, in the future, come up with some sort of scheme on quantifying Clueless Pundits of the Week.
That's a good one.
Because it's unfair to lump all these people together in the same vast mire of cluelessness.
Yes, I know, and I agree with that. That's a good idea.
It's a legitimate criticism.
Well, the clueless pundit kind of thing came out just because I was seeing enough cluelessness that I thought this might be fun to do every week.
And it is. It is fun to do.
And let's. I'll tell you what. Anybody who's interested in suggesting a scale and a metric by which we can measure cluelessness can email me at staff@thelinuxshow.com, and I'll entertain anything, any and all ideas. There you go.
Yes, 1 through 10 cream pies. I don't know.
But you know, also have to have a metric for measuring it too. You know.
True.
It could be somewhat arbitrary.
Kevin, do we have any new product releases mentioned?
Yeah, there's a new development in the Xbox Linux project. Some people have discovered there's a buffer overflow in the game save in the 007 game, so you can actually take out the hard drive, overwrite this file with a program to update your BIOS and put it back in and get Linux to boot without using the mod chip.
Oh, does that include a little bit of soldering, too?
A little bit.
That's what I heard.
But it's definitely getting closer to actually booting straight up on the Xbox.
Yeah, and if it could be done without a mod chip, we've got something special there.
How much is the Xbox these days?
$199, I believe.
Believe so.
Yep. Well, why don't we take a real short break? We are running a little bit behind, but we're going to come back with number two in just a few minutes, and we'll be talking about the care and feeding of a Linux project and talking about a report that was generated by our guests in the next segment. So everybody hang in there and come back for segment number two of the Tuesday night edition of the Linux Show for, what else, April the 15th, 2003, tax day. Gotta hate those taxes. We'll be right back, everybody.
While staring off a game of golf, I may make a play for the caddy. But when I do, I don't follow through, because my heart belongs to Daddy. If I invite a guy from night to dine out to find Gin and Hattie, a deuce to join, he's asking for more, but my heart belongs to Daddy. My heart belongs to Daddy. Simply could it be bad? And my heart belongs to Daddy. It's bad, 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 bad. So well.
welcome back to part two of the Linux Show for April 15, 2003. And our guest for the second half is going to be Eugene Eric Kim. How are you, Eugene?
Good, Russ. Thanks.
All righty. Now, you can find a short bio of him on the Linux Show webpage tonight. He is the executive director and co-founder of Blue Oxen Associates. And previously, he's done a number of different things, including being senior technical editor at Dr. Dobbs Journal, which is a publication that I'm sure a lot of our listeners know very well. And we have tonight a report that Mr. Kim did called An Introduction to Open Source Communities. Would you like to give us a very brief rundown on just what this report is and what it's trying to achieve?
Sure. Well, there were basically two motivations for writing this report. The primary motivation and one of the larger goals that Blue Oxen Associates is trying to pursue is how do we improve communities. And the premise of this report is that open source communities are in fact one of the best examples of communities out there that are leveraging, you know, online resources to accomplish something that is extremely complex. And what we believe is that if we better understand and can identify these processes, that other communities, be they technical, be they, you know, business-oriented, be they nonprofits, and whatnot, other communities can benefit from these as well. So what we're really interested in is identifying what the patterns of high-performance collaboration are within open-source communities. I think the second need that this paper sort of addresses is that, you know, the interest in open source communities and open source in general has been growing quite a bit over the past 5 years, as you well know. And there has been some good research that has been done in the field so far. So one of the things that we wanted to do was aggregate some of the relevant research, talk about some of the studies that have been done and what that means, you know, for what that tells us about open source communities as a whole.
Well, it's very interesting, and quite frankly, one of the things that I found interesting, I was watching some of the responses that that I've seen from the open source community about this particular paper, and of course, there are a lot of people saying, "Well, you know, shouldn't this be self-evident? We all know this stuff. You know, what good is it?"
Yeah.
But when it comes down to it, there are a vast number of people in the world who would respond to this sort of presentation,
right?
And need to have these facts kind of quantified the way that you have.
Right.
Can you talk at all about some of these some of the other communities that you think you know might be interested in what you presented here? Do you have any other further detail on that, or who might be able to benefit from this?
Yeah, well, you talked about education earlier in the show, right? And certainly I think schools, people trying to understand distance learning, that sort of thing. One of the things that was in the report was that one of the major reasons people join open source communities is knowledge acquisition and sharing. And that to us, to me at least, the fact that that was interesting to people, that was a motivation to people, wasn't necessarily surprising, but the fact that it was one of the overwhelming motivations was something that was surprising. And so what are certain things, how do open source communities manage knowledge within the communities? Any community dealing with knowledge management could learn from those kind of things. Indie media. I think indie media is a great example of you know, basically grassroots organizations cropping up and collaborating or wanting to collaborate in interesting ways. And so I think they could benefit from understanding open source models.
You know, it's interesting. You mentioned knowledge management, and that for me, frankly, is a bit of a hot button because I've over the years, I've run into many knowledge management initiatives that have been started by lots of very well-meaning people within corporations. And most of them have been dismal failures,
right?
By any objective measurement.
Right.
And yet, when you take a look what happens in the open source world, you have perhaps the best example of knowledge management in that people who want to find information can find it, and
right.
they can find it quickly,
right.
and yet it goes against the grain entirely of the way knowledge management systems are normally put together.
Yeah.
You know, there's this basic assumption that the idea is to spend all your time classifying knowledge and making it so any idiot can find it. And the end result is that no one spends the time because no one's motivated to spend the time.
Right.
And yet we have the exact opposite in the open source world where, you know, someone with Google and 15 minutes and a little bit of intelligence can basically find the solution to an enormous number of problems. It's an interesting beast.
Absolutely. And there have been a lot of emergent structures in open source communities that companies can learn from. So, you know, just all of these regional user groups, if you're talking about Linux in particular, right, now you have a kind of decentralized support system for finding answers to your questions that are all connected to each other. So if your local user group doesn't know the answer, then, you know, someone is probably connected to a larger group that does know the answer. Some of the summary mailings that go on in a lot of open source communities where people actually summarize, like, you know, the Linux kernel mailing list or, you know, the Perl 6 language, you know, development mailing list, things like that. Like, these are really best practices that are useful. And they're useful because people wouldn't do them if it wasn't useful.
Right. Right. It's not an imposed thing. It's something that's more derived.
That's right.
And inherently useful. The other comment I would make, too, is that, you know, I get a lot of people saying, well, why bother about this? Over the years that I've tried to, you know, sort of evangelize open source and Linux to the business world, one of the biggest problems that you get when you present things to people is, well, do you have a report on that? Doesn't matter that you've said what is true. You need somebody who put together a statistical, well reasoned, with charts, pie graphs type report on the matter.
Yeah.
And this is extremely useful in that regard because it takes good knowledge and puts it out inside a form that a lot of business people require.
Yeah, it's funny. My partner in this venture, Chris Dent, has often commented that it seems like the only thing that people are interested in these reports or the things that people read are the introduction and the conclusion. But they want all that middle stuff to be in there because it legitimizes, you know, the introduction and the conclusion. So.
That is exactly true.
Yeah.
I know it's something that a lot of us technical people sometimes we can't understand that.
Yeah.
That somehow a chart can make everything legitimate. Why that's true, God only knows, but it is true.
Yeah.
You had mentioned that you know, one of the things that surprised you. Do you have other surprises? Things that you hadn't really expected to find, which you found from looking at all this information?
Yeah. Another example, if we talk about demographics, is the fact that the three studies that we looked at pretty much consistently reported 98% male, which surprised me. I mean, I knew there were a lot of men in open source. You know, there are a lot of men in software development. But the fact that it was 98% was kind of a stunning number.
Mm.
And I think there are a lot of implications regarding that as well, and just diversity within communities in general. I mean, what can we learn about diversity within virtual communities, you know, whether people are aware of kind of gender differences or racial differences, ethnic differences and whatnot, or whether those go away because people, you have no idea whether you're talking to someone who's African American or, you know, or Latino or Asian American or whatnot. So that was a number that surprised us. Some of the statistical results surprised us. One of the things that was interesting, we profiled two different communities, TouchGraph and SquirrelMail. And, you know, TouchGraph is probably one of the more representative open source projects in that it's driven by a single developer. It's fairly small kind of niche community, but it's an actively developed project. It's not something that's dead. And SquirrelMail is, you know, very large community, very active user base, very active development team, and so forth. And yet they were aspects of the ways that both of these two communities collaborated that were statistically almost identical. And, you know, this is a sample size of two, so you can't draw too much from that. But it, you know, it leads one to hypothesize that the patterns that exist within these open source communities are actually scalable. And, you know, that's kind of an intriguing notion as well.
And given the given the number of communities out there, that does bring on some interesting concepts.
Yeah.
You know, I was looking at one of the charts inside the report, the reasons to join an open source community,
mm-hmm.
and you know, the big winner in the particular chart I'm looking at, which I think is Figure 2.1 for people who have the report open, you know, is learn and develop new skills.
Yeah.
Almost 79%. But one of the bottom feeders was get a reputation in the open source community at a little over 9%.
Yeah.
And that's one of those things that I think had this been done, say, 4 years ago, that number would be sizably larger. And I think that does reflect some of the changes that have gone on inside the open source world. It seemed to me, from dealing with developers and whatnot back then, that reputation was a whole lot larger of an issue than it is today.
Mm.
And I think it's because of a lot of the early developers were some of the more driven ones inside some respects, and you didn't have the corporations looking to add features and so forth, and you didn't have so many casual people back then. So reputation, I think, would have been a lot higher. But it's interesting to see how these things play out. And for listeners, you know, you can download a version of the paper and see if you can find yourself in all of these charts out there. There's some really interesting items out there.
I found the report interesting in the selection of the two projects. And they were quite interesting the way it was all portrayed. It's a good report.
Thank you.
Yeah, I think also picking a couple projects that that aren't the famous ones, shall we say?
Right.
That is an interesting thing too.
And it's licensed under the open license.
Yeah, it's under a Creative Commons license.
This is also good.
The license itself, it was funny because the explanation for the license on the website is actually a lot more succinct than the license itself. So it is a fairly open license.
Another one too on that chart about motivations, paid versus volunteer.
Mm-hmm.
There are a lot of people that I get when I was doing my column at InfoWorld that seem to insist that unless there was a paycheck, there was no return on this.
Right.
And we know from a business side that isn't true. But when you look at the list of motivations that people have here, and significant ones, you know, intellectual stimulation running over 40%, things like this, this shows that there's a whole lot more to programming than just bits and bucks.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, it's like you said earlier about charts. I mean, you know, anyone who works knows that they are, you know, or who at least enjoys their work or feels fulfilled about it, know that they're motivated by things other than money. And yet, you know, for whatever reasons, we have these models in our heads, and sometimes it takes a chart like this to really, you know, break down those models and really get to the heart of the matter.
Yeah. I think the whole thing is quite cool and quite useful. Have you gotten any interesting responses from people who have looked at the report at this point?
Yeah, I've gotten sort of a mixed response. A lot of the responses that I've read, you know, just from the open source community has been fairly mixed. From as you mentioned earlier, you know, well, you know, what's new here, and you know, to wow, this is interesting. You know, it's great to have all this stuff in one place. The feedback has generally been positive. I think we've actually gone out and we've actually started showing this to people who are not involved in open source communities and who are not necessarily technical, and we're getting good feedback in that regard, which is, you know, our primary goal. So so it's been good so far.
This is another one of those writings that should go along with the Cathedra and the Bazaar. Bazaar as a important document to trot out in front of your non-free software open source friends who maybe are curious about things and how it works. Because the one thing that Eric Raymond has always stressed, some of the community things, but this thing really kind of looks into how it works in practice.
Yeah.
What are the motivations and why it works, maybe. I mean, Eric explains how it works. This explains why it works.
Yeah, Eric, you know, Eric's paper was groundbreaking in that it was one of the first papers that even attempted to address the problem.
Someone's got to break the breakthrough.
Right, and I think it now is an opportune time for us to come out with a paper like this, because now it's appropriate to really analyze these questions and find out, okay, you know, how much of this stuff is true or not, you know, and really get some kind of factual basis for some of the conclusions that we have about open source communities.
I would like to see something done in economics too.
Oh yeah.
I mean, that's something that's not been treated. I mean, that we definitely have something going on here since 1991 with Linux kernel, and I think that the free software movement is making some changing the fabric of software development quite substantially. And
I think it's good.
How does this affect the economics of the thing? I mean, and what are the economics? Does anybody even consider that?
There's a fellow named Stephen Weber who's at UC Berkeley right now, and he's a political economist. He has a book coming out in the spring, I believe, and I hope I'm right about this because I don't want to publicize a book that isn't ready yet, but I believe it's coming out in a few months, and it focuses entirely on the economics of open source.
That should be interesting.
Yeah, so it's I've read some chapters of that, and it's definitely an interesting read.
I mean, there's some stuff, you know, could link that into the motivations too. I mean, there's a lot here.
Dialogue
you've started.
It's all related, and I think it's important too to kind of take this multidisciplinary approach to understanding open source communities. We need to understand it from an anthropological point of view, from an economic point of view, from a political point of view. A lot of the studies so far have been centered on the software development methodologies. And I think that's important, and I think that's valuable, but there's a lot more going on with open source, and it's important to explore that.
All right, cool. Let's give you a quick chance to quickly plug Blue Ox and Associates. What is it that you folks do for a living?
Sure. Well, we're a think tank that's focused on improving collaboration and community building, what we call high-performance collaboration. Our focus primarily has been, to start off with, on research. And, you know, if there are folks out there who are interested in commissioning research of case studies or other kinds of research regarding communities and collaboration, definitely let me know. The other aspect of what we're doing is we actually host collaboratories, which are basically communities of people who are interested in the same problems from all kinds of point of view, whether it's as a tool developer, whether it's someone who's also interested in studying communities and so forth, and actually bring these people together in a community to be kind of partners in the research, and also to experiment, you know, also have them kind of be a laboratory to experiment with some of our ideas about collaboration, collaborative tools and processes and so forth.
Well, that's quite cool. Well, thank you for joining us tonight. We appreciate the paper that you did. We appreciate you coming on and talking to us about it.
Thank you, Russ. I enjoyed that.
Keep up the great work, and keep us tuned in for any additions that you may have made to the document or changes, so that we can keep our listeners informed of the status. And I tell you, Arnie, I agree with you. That needs to be added onto the pantheon of important resource writing for the day, along with some of the other great papers that have been written. So great job.
Wow. Well, thank you very much. I'm going to quote you guys on that. So
feel free.
Right ahead.
Feel free.
And you're going to need to come back if you produce anything more like that. You need to get in contact. We'll see what you get back on, and because it's very interesting work.
Well, as long as I'm not picked for your clueless pundit of the week.
Oh, no. I don't think so. Not likely to happen. It's good stuff.
Okay. Well, I tell you, we are way after the 9 o'clock hour, and frankly, folks, I got to get working on taxes. So on behalf of the whole crew here at the Lennox Show, we're going to call it an evening. I would like to address everybody's attention to our website, www.thelennoxshow.com. Make sure that all you people listening, all you people on the IRC right now, go sign up to the Lennox Show email list. Tell your friends to sign up on the email list. And while you're at it, if you want to register a domain name or just give us a donation, we appreciate all the support you can give us to keep this show on the air. We really do appreciate it. I tell you, we actually had about 15 or 20 domain names registered in the past week alone, and it's not a fortune, but, you know, a couple bucks here, a couple bucks there, it all adds up. At least it's paying the phone bill, and that's really all we're hoping to do with some of these smaller fundraising projects. So our thanks go out to all of you for recommending our domain registration tool to your friends. So keep it up, but make sure you do join the email list so you can be in on the big Geek Pack announcement. We were going to have the Geek Pack announcement for tonight, but we got bogged down in taxes, so it'll have to wait till next week's show. So until then, on behalf of the whole crew here at the Linux Show, thanks to everybody. Keep coming back. We'll be back next week with who's the guest, Russ?
Someone from JBoss. I don't have the name in front of me.
Okay, well, somebody from JBoss. We'll be back next week, everybody. This has been the Tuesday night edition of the Linux Show for Tax Day, April 15th, 2003. We're out of here.
Although I've never been to Rio, there's something saying to me, go. 'Cause there's a chance I just might find my big romance there, Rio de Janeiro. Tomorrow I may fly to Rio, to find the love I need to know. Someone is waiting for me somewhere, and it could be Rio de Janeiro. Show me how to get to Rio. I need some space to just unwind. There is a real thing that is Rio, but with Rio, it's possibly a state of mind.
leaving you in prayer. Don't tell me it's too much to dream, because I visualize a wonderful sensation. It's my one and only thing. There'll be some time to spend in Rio. I feel it's not too far away, and I will hear the samba playing and the music. You'll be all that they say that you love me. Let my surprise be and return and touch me. Chances are you won't speak Castilian or be Brazilian, but it's a hot mess to watch. 'Cause if I never get to Rio,
dear, my heart is singing. we can glide and sway.
Chevrons,
let me stop away
with you.
We can glide and sway.
Savons,
let me stop away.
Wait.